So today you're here to join us to listen to Professor Levinson. Mira Levinson is Associate Professor of Education at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. Her research interests include civic education, multiculturalism, educational justice, and youth empowerment. She draws upon scholarship from multiple disciplines, as well as her 8 years of experience teaching in the Atlanta and Boston public schools. She's currently working on a project on justice in schools that will combine philosophical analysis and school-based case studies in the way that she's known so well for doing. Her most recent major work is this year, No Citizen Left Behind, published in 2012. I'll circulate for you to look at in lieu of a book table of some sort. Also, she's an editor and contributor toward a book, Making Civics Count. And she's also the author of a terrific philosophical work called The Demands of Liberal Education that I commend to you. Her BA is from Yale, and her PhD in politics is from Oxford. And please welcome me in joining Professor Mira Levinson.
I'm really thrilled to be here. And my understanding is I should talk for like 10 or 15 minutes.
15 minutes is
15
good.
15 minutes. Okay.
Yep.
All right. So I will, in fact, set my timer so that I don't go over. I think what I will do is just sort of lay out, I mean, I was thinking about, is it better to try to give something focused in 15 minutes for you really to talk about, or should I sort of give you a lot of tantalizing things that, you know, maybe you can glom onto, and I decided to do the tantalizing approach. So it's going to be a very superficial sort of trip through a whole bunch of different ideas that then we can get into detail in. The basic thing, the fundamental argument that I make, say, in No Citizen Left Behind, is that we have a civic empowerment gap in this country that is as profound and as shameful as the academic achievement gap is, and that we have the same kind of obligation in all areas of our society, including in schools, to tackle the civic civic empowerment gap, just as we have started to take on this obligation to tackle the academic achievement gap. And that then there are a whole variety of ways in which we can do that, particularly in schools, which is what I'm interested in because that's where I came out of, basically. So to trace that argument, it makes sense to start with saying what the civic empowerment gap means. Essentially, it is a renaming of a social, political, civic phenomenon that we have been, perfectly aware of now for decades, that is probably the thing that political scientists especially have documented above all else in this country, which is that people with higher levels of education, with more money, who are native English speakers, who are native-born as opposed to naturalized citizens, and in most cases who are whiter as opposed to browner, have more civic and political power in this country. We have tons of evidence about that with regard to voting. And I should say that African Americans have historically been actually the most active civically and politically when you control for class and levels of education. Although that is now starting to drop, except for the thanks to Obama, it may actually be rising again. But with the decline of the black church, at least I think for a while, it had started dropping. But especially Latinos and Asians in this country are vastly underrepresented, as we know, in elective office and other things, but also in terms of basically every measure of civic and political engagement that we have. And those who are lower income and have lower levels of education are also vastly underrepresented in every measure of political and civic engagement that we have and empowerment that we have. So, for example, just to take the recent elections, we don't have data yet from 2012, but we have data from 2010, from 2008, and before. Those with, graduate degrees, over 80% of citizens in the United States with graduate degrees voted, and under 30% of high school dropouts citizens voted in recent elections, right? So humongous disparities. Even if you compare those with only some college or a college degree to those with no college attendance, we end up having a difference of about 50%. So you are 50% more likely to have voted if you are a citizen with at least some experience of college than if you're a citizen with no experience of college. There was Rich Coley at ETS did a fascinating calculation looking at the 2006 midterm elections as it happened, comparing very specific groups. So looking at somebody who was about between 24 and 29 years old who had not attended college and who was low income, a person of color. 8%, I think it was, of citizens who had those characteristics voted in the 2006 midterm election, whereas 39% of a middle-income 24 to 29-year-olds who were white and had some college experience voted. Again, 39% is not an amazing number, right, percentage, but it was the midterm elections, after all, where we have a proud history of not voting. But more to the point, it's a fivefold difference, right? So in terms of thinking about comparative power, it's a massive difference in comparative power. If you look at both the 2010 midterm elections, the 2008 presidential elections, white and black citizens were 40 to 50% more likely to have voted in that election than Hispanic and Asian citizens. And it's important to remember, I keep saying citizens, this is not about who lives in this country who does not have citizenship status, although that's an important consideration in and of itself. These are all gaps among citizens. And these are gaps also, in most cases, what I'm quoting to you takes into account the institutional and systematic disenfranchisement, say, of felons and former felons and others who may have lost the right to vote thanks to state laws. So this, again, is not about, it's among the voting eligible population we have these disparities. And these disparities are really persistent. And they exist way beyond voting. It's also being contacted by elected officials, contacting elected officials, contacting other governmental officials, volunteering, protesting, what you can think of as outsider activities, not just insider activities. It persists in the digital sphere as well as in the offline sphere. They are persistent, and they are measurable, and they are dramatic. One way of responding to that could be to say, well, then it's natural, right? This is just the way things are, and we just need to take this as a given and not try to tackle it. But there is good evidence from outside the United States that whereas these gaps exist, they are much, much smaller. Say, across most of Europe, the gaps, say, in voting participation... We got a 10 to 15% difference by education. So those, say, who were school leavers at some point in what we consider high school vote at 10 to 15% below the rates of those who have some experience of higher education. That's a lot smaller than 20, 30, 40, or 50% gaps that we have in this country. And by income also, there are gaps, but they are much smaller in countries outside the United States. And we have certainly seen examples of people's movements and of other movements in Latin America, we've certainly seen it in the Middle East recently, right? Although there is some evidence that there was a large, a lot of those, say, especially in Egypt, were educated who participated. A lot of people who participated in those kinds of movements also came from fairly disenfranchised populations. And we have that much less in this country. The other thing is that historically over time, the United States has not always been as unequal in terms of political and civic representation and power as it is now. So it's not just this immediate thing about, say, Citizens United and the proliferation of money and the growth of economic inequality in the United States, although that has certainly in the very short term exacerbated this problem. This problem has existed for decades, but again, it was much better, say, a century ago than it is now. When labor unions were strong, when churches were stronger, And when immigrant and corporation groups were stronger, frankly, also when political machines were stronger. It's not that this was necessarily the most democratic means of equalizing participation, but there were institutions through which low-income workers and immigrants were gradually brought into the civic and political fold in the United States that we now do not have to the same extent. So those arguments, sort of comparing us to Europe and comparing us to ourselves, say, at the beginning of the 20th century, are both to say this is not an inevitable or a natural state of affairs, any more than the academic achievement gap is an inevitable or natural state of affairs. So one of the reasons that I talk about the civic empowerment gap is as a very intentional echo of the language around the academic achievement gap, is because I think there's been a really salutary shift in this country in thinking about who is responsible for, what the causes of are, and who is responsible for addressing the academic achievement gap. So when I started teaching in 1996 in Atlanta, it was relatively common for say, colleagues and others to blame kids for their academic failure, right? Their heads are in the rap music or in basketball or in the girls as opposed to in school. They don't care. Their parents don't care. Their parents are so busy working multiple jobs. They don't get enough sleep. They don't have books in their home. Whatever the reasons are given, right? It was always locating the fault in the child, him or herself. And it was seen as being, again, then if you broaden that and took that to an institutional and social-wide analysis, the assumption was, well, they don't have books in their homes, they are too busy, they don't value education. Of course you're going to see these academic differences. These are natural states of affairs. It is natural that an African-American 12th grader, on average, reads at the same level as a white 8th grader. What do you expect? Over the last 15 years, there has been a really important shift in this country where that kind of explanation is no longer publicly acceptable and in many cases is not even privately embraced anymore. Schools, school districts, the education establishment in this country, and political institutions, our nation, our districts, et cetera, cities, have said, you know what? We can no longer say that it's these children's bodies, these children's families, these children's communities that are at fault for academic failure. We have to take ownership of the problem. We have to say we are responsible for educating all children to a high level. It is not natural that a black kid in America reads so much worse on average than a white kid, that it is because of things that we are systematically doing, ways in which we are systematically underserving our kids, and we are going to make a change. My argument is that we need to take that same sense of ownership over the civic empowerment gap and say, again, these are not natural, inevitable states of affairs. To have it be demographically predictable in a democracy who has power and who doesn't. That is wrong. It is shameful. It's anti-democratic. It's illegitimate. And it's anti-democratic not only as a matter of principle, in that as a matter of principle, we should have a more inclusive set of political and civic actors. It also shoots us in the foot as a matter of practice. We would be better off as a society if we had a more inclusive and empowered polity. We would make better decisions. And that's because the more diverse perspectives and voices you have in a conversation, the more insights you are likely to gain. And especially the more diverse perspectives and insights and experiential knowledge that you can pull in from the people, those very people whom we are trying to serve in our policies, the better policies we are likely to make. So Eric and I were talking before this began, and he said, you know, are you saying that we'd have a stronger democracy because we would sort of shift our policy focus to those who have been more underserved? And I said, well, partly. But in fact, we already do have many policies that focus on those who are underserved. We have job creation policies, we have education policies, we have welfare policies, we have all sorts of policies. And many of them are not very good ones. They're not very effective ones. And that's because, I think, in many cases, they are devised by people who have little on-the-ground experience of or knowledge of how they work and how they could work and what the characteristics are of the communities that they themselves are trying to serve. And so we would be, actually, we would come up with better, more efficient ways to spend my tax dollars if we had a more inclusive, democratic sort of conversation and more empowered people, regardless of also other people's interests that might be served if they had more civic and political power. So then the question is, all right, let's say you take on board the civic empowerment gap as a cause, then what should we do about it? There are lots of things we could do outside of schools and need to do outside of schools. I'm happy to talk about them, but I won't say anything about it right now because I think I have about, 27 seconds
it's
left.
It's flexible. Okay. It's a guideline, right. Not a rule. Yes.
Just to sort of throw out as hints of a set of arguments that I make in the book that I'm happy then to expand on, I'll just walk you through with about 10 seconds each on the arguments. So one set of things that we need to do differently is actually teach a different curriculum. So partly we actually need to teach some civic education. Right now, for those of you who grew up in the United States and especially attending public schools, my guess is that you had a 12th grade government class that probably was pretty dreadful and boring and certainly never gave you the opportunity to actually try to take part in government in any way or to, you know, you learned about government as opposed to doing government. And you may have had some other class that addressed civic issues in some way. You may have had a social studies teacher who was particularly excited about it. Maybe you had a current events class. Maybe you had a facing history class that dealt with, you know, civics in some way. But probably the only formal civic education most of you have had was 12th grade government, by which point many, especially low-income kids of color in this country, are no longer in schools, right? Because we have a close to 50% dropout rate in many, many urban areas. So we need to teach more civic education. We also need to teach better civic education. As I hinted at, it's not just teaching kids about civics. It's teaching kids to be citizens, to do civics. In English, in math, in science, in baseball, we think that to get kids to be good at something, they need to do it. They need to read, they need to do math, they need to write, they need to pitch, they need to catch, they need to do experiments. Bizarrely, even though being a citizen is the one role and responsibility that we can count on virtually everybody, all of the students that we are serving, whether or not they're formal legal citizens, they have civic responsibilities and civic rights, it's the one role we can count on everybody having. We almost never in our schools give kids the opportunity to practice being citizens. And if we do, it's for a very brief period of time in a kind of segmented way, rather than every single day, every year, every month, every week, having kids practice doing civics. And that can be through a whole variety of ways. In part, respectful discussion and deliberation in classrooms, debates, simulations, etc. School governance, having school government that actually has a real budget and makes real decisions, that has actually an institution and policy role to play in the school, whether it's reviewing curriculum, being on a teacher hiring committee, whatever. Extracurriculars in which kids have leadership roles and which are kid-directed as opposed to solely adult-directed. And then also internships, public speaking, you know, actually lobbying for things, a whole variety of ways in which kids could actually do civics through schools. Also, how we teach history, I argue, needs to be changed, especially for those who are at the right now the bottom of the civic empowerment gap. We tend to teach history in a way that emphasizes that we live in a wonderful country that had a couple stains in the beginning, like slavery, but we've gotten past that, and really we stand for equality and freedom, and we're sort of always charging forward and getting better all the time. And kids in many neighborhoods, in many circumstances, don't have that as their experience of the United States. And so when we teach this idea that the United States is this wonderful place that they should become a part of because it's so great, they often feel quite a strong disconnect from that. And if instead we could tap into the civic narratives and historical narratives that they are growing up with and say, yeah, you know, slavery wasn't just this accidental temporary stain. It was woven into the fabric of our Constitution. It is part of our very DNA. It's actually, I argue in the book, that it's a notion of original sin. That slavery is one of our original sins, and just like with original sin, you always have to fight against it. It's not as if you do it once and then you leave it behind, but it's this constant struggle. Similarly, we can read our history as a constant struggle against certain original sins in our character that have brought amazing opportunities. And then we have an obligation to make use of those opportunities to continue the struggle. And that might be a civic historical narrative that has more resonance with many young people who might then be inspired to become involved, not because this is a great country and don't you want to be a part of it too, because I have opportunities thanks to the struggle of others and I have an obligation to continue that struggle. I also talk in the book about teaching code switching as a conscious act, a political act, about teaching solidarity, collective action, double consciousness, about reshaping how, when we teach, say, history from individual heroes to more ordinary role models. I talk a lot about school culture and classroom culture and how those set up certain kinds of civically empowering and disempowering relationships and what we could do about that. And then finally, I talk about standards and assessments and accountability measures, since those are sort of central to the education reform world that we live in today, both in the United States and globally, and how we might think about tweaking those as a way of making those both still engines of democracy for adult participation, but also more empowering for kids so they become more empowered democratic citizens. With that, I'll stop, probably 4 minutes long. Sorry.
No, it's terrific. Thank you very much.